call to order the Subcommittee on Redistricting. We have in front of us today House File 1425. And I want to take, I'd like to take the public testimony on this at the front end. But I want to ask Mr. Bodern to just kind of procedurally point out what is in front of us, what this committee will be looking at and acting on this afternoon.
So, Mr. Chairman, House File 1425, as you have it before you, in Section 1, adopts a legislative redistricting plan that has been filed with the LCC on its website for these purposes. And that plan is very detailed and is available in full there. Section 2 amends the existing procedures that are provided in law for coding a meets and bounds description of the districts, the legislative districts, and changes that to include a reference to both a legislative enactment and a court order, and provides a deadline for providing that meets and bounds description of the legislative districts. And actually that applies, I believe, yeah, it's both legislative districts and congressional districts. Section 3 provides districting principles that are substantially similar, I think, in just about all respects to those this committee has considered on previous occasions, and provides an effective date for that that is also identical to what has been seen before, and that these principles expire June 1st, 2012. What is also new here is that Section 4 repeals several sections of law, and those are reprinted in the back, in the last two pages of what you have in front of you. Each of these sections relates to the previous redistricting efforts. All of them are related to corrections the legislature made to the court plan that was put into place in 2002. They will become obsolete when a new plan is enacted. There is finally an effective date that provides these districts apply to beginning with the state primary election in 2012 and thereafter.
And so, Mr. Bodern, and I note with some irony with Senator Rest here. So, Senator Rest, in the appendix, the two specific districts that are referenced are 41, which I have some familiarity with, and 45.
Obviously not changing the Senate district, but the internal boundaries for the House district that passed actually on the last night's session.
And so, Mr. Bonner, just to be clear then, we have a state plan in front of us, a state legislative district plan, and we have the districting principles that were discussed and passed by this committee. That is in one piece before us. Can you also just briefly describe what else is in members' packets? A couple of pieces.
Mr. Chairman, there are two other items, and these have been prepared by the staff for the LCC GIS office. And the paper-clipped documents you have in front of you are comparisons of each of the legislative districts, and actually, to be specific, the Senate districts, and they give you reports about the total population, the percentage of minority population, both by absolute numbers and voting age, and there are several other comparisons, including a contiguity report and measures of compactness, according to several different scales, and a listing of political subdivision splits. The larger document that is bound basically contains maps of each of the Senate districts and some larger maps that show you certain regions of the state, such as the Duluth area and so forth. And you'll find each of the Senate districts contained within this document. And if you have particular questions about how these were prepared or what they contain, I think Mr. Millier is here as well from the GIS office.
Thank you, Mr. Millier. Members, we do have a number of folks who've asked to testify, and so I'd like to take some public testimony here at the front end, and it sounds like there's a few others that have added, so maybe we'll just go off the list to begin here. So we have the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Please, if you could join us at the table here. And hang on a second, ma'am. Thank you for joining us. And members, you know, depending on what we are hearing from the testifiers or once we get into questions from committee members, let's try to identify if we have specific questions or if members of the public are testifying about a specific district. Let's literally make sure we're on the same page. So we might want to stop briefly as people are trying to compare. I watched the House hearing, and sometimes people refer to the current districts, but they're looking at the proposed map or vice versa, so we'll just make sure we're literally all looking at the same thing. And there may well be testimony that is just much more general in nature.
Sorry.
I don't mean to make you run around. If you could state your name for the record and tell us what organization you represent, and welcome to the committee.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eileen Herr, and I am the Executive Director for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And I swear I had my redistricting maps with me when I walked on over here, but now I can't seem to find them, but that's okay. I am here on the behalf of the Asian Pacific community that I'm charged and mandated to represent. We are a state agency, and we are charged to advocate for the Asian Pacific Islander community statewide. And I want to come here to encourage you to continue to protect the sort of the one vote, one person rule. And in light of that, I did want you to encourage you to really strengthen the minority majority districts that there are in Minnesota, particularly since the Asian American community, 85% reside in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and primarily a large percentage of them is in Ramsey County, and one out of almost 33% of all Asian Pacific Minnesotans are from the Hmong community, and the Hmong community tends to reside in St. Paul on the east side and also in the Frogtown area, and a little bit in Minneapolis, but now growing in Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, in that you work really hard to protect their voting power, be as it may. The Asian American population, again, like I said, is 85% in the metropolitan area, and they are within the, and they are the residents that make up the percentages in the majority minority districts. In particular, I like to speak to Senate District 66, in that there are growing Asian population in those two districts. And as you have, some of you have had the pleasure to serve with Senator Mimua, who was from the 67th District, and it was by no accident that she became the first Hmong elected official in the state of Minnesota, and coming to the Minnesota State Legislature, and coming from the east side, coming from an area where there is a significant Hmong American population that are now young and emerging voters. And of course, her election then really motivated and inspired the community to really get out there and be politically active and civically engaged. And so my concern a little bit is trying to protect the Hmong vote within 67. and making sure that whatever voting power they have within that district does not get diluted or does not get poured into, say, more of a 66 or even, and I don't, again, like I said, I don't have my maps in front of me. I don't know if 65 would then intrude into that area. But, and then I also noticed that in 66 and 65, and I will speak for a community that I have grown to love and to appreciate, in my colleagues within the African American community, and just my concern that it seems to me that 66 and 65 is sort of divided along sort of the University Avenue corridor, which then splits the African American and then a growing Asian American vote. As you can see, if you go along University to the north and to the south, there are significant population. And my question is that with that line right in the middle, that would it then dilute or would it split the African American and the Asian American vote within 66 and 65? And so I'm here to just to talk a little bit about that, those two districts, but overall on the statewide level, I know that the Asian American population is growing in certain districts, and making sure that even among city lines, and I can share a little bit with you, is that different communities are organized differently. So say in Minneapolis, there are Powderhorn, north-south Minneapolis, and then in St. Paul, there are planning districts, and making sure that those communities are not then divided too, because it takes a lot of work just to organize community at a community organizing level, and then to have the district's line to kind of split them would be, to my in my mind, if not stopping them, then kind of hindering their organizing power. And I will stop it there.
Thank you, Ms. Herr. And did you share some of this testimony last week with the House committee? Because there was an amendment made that I think very specifically, which is now contained in the bill in front of us, that talks specifically about Senate District 66 and 67. So maybe we should give you credit for that.
Senator, we have been working with the House, and I have presented in front of them. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
And members, so not too hard to figure out where in the book District 66 and 67 are. I can give some more specific numbers here in Senate District 66. Well, 66B would be 34% Asian, as referenced by Ms. Herr. And then over on 67, that's 67A, 22% Asian. And I made reference that I should make this more clear. So our House counterparts had a hearing last week and took hours of testimony, including some specific testimony about districts and districts lines, and they ended up making an amendment that and passing an amendment on the floor of the House, which we have in front of us, and that included some changes in 67 and 66. So again, I think recognizing the testimony that Ms. Herr has given in both places. So thank you, Ms. Herr. I also have Hector Garcia on our list. Mr. Garcia?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. Could you just state your name?
Thank you, committee members. I'm Hector Garcia, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I wanted to convey our concern as a community because of the very short period of time that was allotted to the review of the documents that are being discussed. We haven't had much time to see the effects of the new map, But from a quick evaluation that we did, it seems that District 61, Senate District 61, which currently has a 26.7% Latino population, would go down to, under the proposed plan, down to 4.5%. 63, which currently has 13.9% of Latinos, would decrease to 8.8%. 67 would go from 12.9 to 13, so that's actually a minimal increase. 65 would go from 12.8% to 3.9%, and 39 would go from 10.8 to 3.9%. And there are a larger number of House districts that would also show a considerable decrease. I just wanted you to be aware of those decreases in regards to the Latino community, and to also share with you our great interest in having Latinos participate more in the political system, which we're not prone to do as a community. So it's very important for us to try to take advantage of our numbers whenever possible to persuade our community to get engaged, get involved, and make a contribution through their expressed opinions. And I'm afraid that our community, which is already fragmented and marginalized, would become even more so with the type of decreases that I just mentioned to you. Thank you.
And Mr. Garcia, just I want to make sure that I have the numbers right here. Could you go through one more time the specific Senate districts that you were looking at?
Sure. And I hope these are correct, as we had to rush through the evaluation.
61.
63, 65, and 39.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia. And just to be clear for the record here for you as we go forward, so the plan that is now in front of this committee is substantially similar to what was introduced and publicized last week.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've all had at least a week. Maybe your organization hasn't taken that much time to look at it, but I hope that's at least enough time for a good start for you.
What did come to us,
Garcia.
Yes, Mr. Chair, what did come to us was the map, and that was one day before the House committee meeting, and the website where we were able to get these numbers that I just mentioned to you, we received yesterday. Perhaps we missed something, I'm not sure. But yes, the map did come to us about a week ago. And again, I'd like to share with you our concern in getting our community to be more engaged, not less engaged, in the political process, because a marginalized community is of no good to anyone, nor to the state of Minnesota.
And Mr. Garcia, am I right that is there someone else from the Chicago Latino Affairs
Yes.
Council that was going to testify with you, or
that is correct? Gerardo Bonilla, the vice chair of our board.
Do you want to bring that?
Certainly. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia. You can certainly stay up there if you want to do this together.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman and Council members, or committee members, excuse me. My name is Gerardo Bonilla. I'm actually the Vice Chair of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. I just want to reiterate some of the concerns. I actually testified in the House committee meeting about a week ago. And I just want to reiterate some of my concerns. As Hector has alluded to there, and the executive director for the Asian Pacific Minnesotans, there is this map has is going to have a big impact on our communities who already small in numbers. And some of the districts, I haven't gotten a chance to look at them fully and in depth. But from what I've seen there, like Hector has alluded to, there is some of the new districts proposed do dilute some of the populations within the districts, thus diluting the vote and not having proper representation, in my opinion. And I just want to reiterate, you know, saying that we need a little more time to really look at what's going to happen after, if this goes forward, what's going to happen to these communities. I don't think as a community member, I don't think I had enough time to really look at what's going to happen, look at these district, look at the proposed map, even though I did have a week, but I don't think a week is more than enough time to actually analyze it and talk to community members about the impact of this. You know, I want to reiterate what Hector says, that our community really wants to get involved and be a part of this process. And I think one way to do that is to ensure that we have, you know, there's proper representation and engagement and outreach.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. And if you have any technical questions, there's a lot of people in this room that can help you. And we can provide some resources and materials. And Mr. Milliard, if you just raise your hand, that's probably one of the best resources right there to actually get down to street level of these districts.
Yeah, and that's really helpful. And thank you for offering that. But it's just, I guess my question and concern is having community members not having access to, I forgot his name, apologize. But the people like him and having the tools to actually access it, I guess that's my concern. Because, you know, as I can honestly say that some of my friends don't even know that this meeting is going on, and I just want to make sure that everyone has a voice and has access to the resources to give good input.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia.
Appreciate it.
So, members, we have a couple other folks who've asked to testify, and maybe I should let me just get this on the record. So what is in front of us today is a state plan that fits our principles, the principles passed by this committee earlier. It's worth repeating at least once more. So because of the population shifts, in Minnesota, we're required to do this every 10 years, and so we need to honor the one person, one vote concept. We talked about the importance of trying to prevent splitting subdivisions, counties, cities, townships. We need to adhere to the Voting Rights Act, importance of minority representation, and, of course, communities of interest. I am pleased to say what stands out in my mind about this particular plan is the number 32. This splits 32 counties and only 32 cities, which is actually pretty remarkable when you think that there are over 800 cities in Minnesota, and we've been able to put together something that meets our principles and literally holds together 96% of the city boundaries within these lines. So I think that's something we can focus on and feel good about. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, since we're making statements for the record, Democrats on the committee still object to the process by which we are dealing with redistricting. And you've mentioned now, I think, the third time that redistricting principles were passed by this committee. They have not been passed by the full Senate. And what we have is a it's hard to know whether the plan came first or the principles. And when they are in the same document, it is once again we are very disappointed with the process. For the record.
Well, Senator Est, with all due respect, I think it's pretty easy to figure out what came first. We spent a couple hours on those principles a week or so ago. So,
Mr. Chairman, the map was released during our discussion.
Can I just finish?
Sure.
So those principles that were passed are now part of this document, and I think that's exactly where they belong. I appreciate you had some ideas for some additions to the principles, but this committee spent a good amount of time on that. So we also have...
So, Mr. Chairman, may I reply?
Senator Rest.
So, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, and I think the record would show on the tape, the plan was being released by the House, which is pretty much what we're dealing with here, during the course of our discussion. And so they really weren't Senate principles. They were a map that was being drawn to which the principles had to be shoehorned. For the record.
Well, should we just keep going back and forth for the record, Senator Rask?
No.
You're
the one who started it.
The plan in front of us meets our principles and meets it very well. So I also have Mr. Dean? Mr. Dean from Common Cause. And I guess I'd ask if there's anyone else in the room who would like to testify in front of the committee today, if you'd maybe approach one of the staff here and just let us know. Thank you. Mr. Dean, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. We're a nonpartisan government watchdog group. And as I testified previously, we've spent a lot of time looking at redistricting over the last 30 years. In particular, we've paid close attention to this process the entire time. I've either been at all the House hearings and the Senate hearings or listened to them on tape. And so we've been monitoring this process closely. And at the beginning of the legislative session, leaders from both sides of the aisle talked about how this process was going to be fair, open, and transparent. And unfortunately, the process that you've proceeded with so far has failed to really abide by that pledge. This map is really the product of a failed process that's lacked the level of transparency and citizen input that's really necessary to restore sort of the public faith in the redistricting process. I think there's a lot of suspicion of the redistricting process, partially because of what we've seen in other states when legislators have the ability to choose their voters. What I want to talk about briefly is both the process you've proceeded with so far and the outcomes. And I think what I've seen, in my opinion, is that map is nothing more than a partisan gerrymander. Unfortunately, the process you've been engaged in did not even meet the minimum standards of transparency. Back in March, Common Cause, along with a coalition of other nonprofits, outlined 11 recommendations on how you could improve the process. So far, you've only adopted one of those principles, and that's around creating principles. And as Senator Rest just alluded to, those principles, it's unclear to me and the public, I think whether what came first, the chicken or the egg, the map or the principles. And we saw this in the House, where in the House they adopted principles on the Thursday, and the map was released basically two business days later. So I find it hard to believe that the maps were actually produced sort of considering the principles. I think it's more likely that maps were produced far ahead of time and then the principles came along with. And that's not how redistricting should really be happening at all. It now appears that the map was really sort of Let me continue on, that the public, I think, really doesn't have much faith in the process so far. They're not going to have faith in a process that really does not value competition. And I testified previously to the importance of competition, and unfortunately that was not incorporated into the principles. Also, you've allowed for incumbents to be protected, and you've failed to really sort of require greater transparency. I think the process in which the maps were released really has been indicative of the lack of transparency, particularly in the House, where the maps were only given 24 hours notice to the public to review them. And it's clear to me that really the maps are drawn completely behind closed doors without real transparency. And I think what we're asking for and what we've been asking for since the very beginning is for you basically to show us your work. So if you remember back in grade school when you were doing math problems, you were often asked by your teachers to show us your work. And it's a concept that should not be that foreign to us, in that the reason that's often done is to basically prevent cheating from happening when it comes to math questions. And I think that this is really critical when it comes to redistricting, is that it's important for you to state sort of why, how the map was drawn, sort of what was the process, but more importantly, to justify reasoning for why certain decisions were made. And we failed to really see that. A map is basically just kind of put out there with no clear justification. And so it's clear to me that the public then is left to wonder, all right, how were decisions made in this process? What things were actually considered? Were partisan numbers considered during the process at all? And so without that, I think you're going to have a real sort of lack of public faith in this process. And I think it's even more concerning what's happened here over in the Senate, particularly that there hasn't been a single public hearing on this, whether it be going out to the community. When we spoke with Mr. Chair, when we spoke with you earlier on in the process, our understanding is that there were going to be public hearings from the Senate side on this. And it's unfortunate that there has not been a single one. Going out to the community, I think, is really critical part in the process, and so there's been no real hearings. So it's really evident that the redistricting process really has been flawed here so far. And I think if you look at the House testimony, and I hope you've all reviewed the House testimony, because that's really been the only public input that's existed, there's really been a lack of public input in the process. So the House had a total of three public hearings in Hermantown, Marshall, and Rochester. They didn't go anywhere in the Twin Cities at all. And out of those public hearings, basically 45 individuals testified. Of those 45 individuals, only 15 were from the public. And not until last Tuesday's hearing did we really get true public input in the process. And I was pleased to see that this House at least took some of that into consideration during this process. But I think we have seen, unfortunately, not enough public engagement. Because really that public input is critical to the process because they understand these communities and how they're organized. If you look at what's been happening across the country with redistricting in states like Arizona and California, there's been significant public input in the process where they've actually had hundreds of testifiers come forward. And we've heard about sort of the public sort of having their faith restored in the redistricting process because of that high level of engagement. And the process is engaged in, organizing. I think in California they've had something like 25 public hearings. In Arizona they're organizing at least 20. And what we're seeing is a process where it's clearly laid out so the people understand what's going on. And then there's an adequate time to review a map that's being proposed. The reason that you don't see many people here testifying today is a few. One is that you're holding this hearing during the day. So it's very difficult for average citizens to come out and really sort of testify in the maps. And two, they feel that their public input is not going to be really considered. After they saw what happened at last Tuesday's House redistricting hearing, where really the public was largely dismissed by committee members during the process. Now, however, the House went back afterwards and incorporated some of that testimony into changes. I feel that they did not go far enough at all. And so I think it's really challenging for the public to really feel truly engaged in this process. And so what I want to lay out finally is kind of my concerns about the outcomes of this map, and really sort of in three areas. The one is around the partisan gerrymandering that we've seen. Common Cause did some analysis looking at the partisan makeup of the legislative plan and found out that of the districts created on the House side, 82 would be considered Republican-leaning districts, and 52 would be considered Democratic-leaning districts. And so that puts the DFL at a significant disadvantage as part of this plan. We also engaged Professor Michael McDonald, who is a national expert on redistricting, to analyze the political bias in the plan. And he produced a report, which we released last week, on the plan. And he found that there was significant political bias in this plan that you're considering today, where he estimated that Democrats would need to win 53% of the vote in order to basically just win a majority of the legislative seats, and so found that there is sort of significant political bias. I'd be happy to share that memo with the committee. He used a methodology that's widely respected on both sides of the aisle, that's been used in redistricting lawsuits all over the country, specifically in Texas, where this has been hotly contested, but used the methodology to really look at this and was concerned about the partisan gerrymandering and the political bias that we saw on this map. The second area where I have concerns is around the incumbent protection. If you look at sort of the end results, there is, I would describe it as significant incumbent protection, partially around, if you look at the number of DFLers paired against each other, which is five, compared to only one of GOP versus GOP, and then there are four, this is on the House side, four pairings of DFL and GOP. If you look at the past maps produced either by the court or the nonpartisan sort of governor's plan, you see significantly more pairings. And in those pairings, they're much more politically biased or balanced, and they're not politically biased, which is what I think you see in this plan. And then on the Senate plan that you've produced, there are three pairings, and those are all on the DFL side, none for the GOP and none DFL versus GOP. And so this appears that it is sort of an incumbent protection plan, which I think the public has significant concerns about because of what we've seen in other states, that too often the redistricting process is used to protect political incumbents. And then lastly, I want to mention just the number of minority opportunity districts created. The minority population in the state has been growing significantly, and so you would expect a significant increase. And in this map, you did increase the number of minority opportunity districts, but I felt that you really didn't go far enough. Because if you look at the minority population in the state, it's now about 17 or 18%. And so if you sort of correlated that directly with the number of seats, minority opportunity seats, you don't have enough there. And so I think you really need to work harder to create additional minority opportunity districts as you move forward. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or share any of the documentation that I have.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. That was a mouthful there.
Yes.
The one thing you did note, and I want to make sure it's clear, so I think you were a part of this testimony in the other body last week that did result in an amendment. So input was taken, changes were made, and I've got a count here. I think 11 different districts were impacted by changes since this plan was produced and proposed and unveiled. So that sounds to me like the public process of the legislature is working. 11 different districts benefited from this public vetting. So I appreciate you would have liked maybe a little more of a timeline. But I think that's important for members to know. So 11 different changes were made,
Mr. Chair,
which are now incorporated in this in 1425 in front of us. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dean, I have not looked at all the differences, but given that there were, well, take the chairman's word for it, 11 differences, did that make any of those districts more competitive?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dean.
No, it did not. They were largely cosmetic changes that I think addressed concerns regarding sort of minority districts. One of these districts was actually my own, and it was a good change in that you see sort of major, basically African-American community was split in half, and so the changes that they made reduced that split significantly. But in terms of the partisan breakdown or the political bias that existed, there were not significant changes at all in that.
And Mr. Dean, if you could share that report with members of the committee, I think that would be of interest. I recall you and Senator Gerlach had a little back and forth on what is competitiveness and how is it measured. So you gave a few numbers in your testimony earlier. Can you describe for us, at least in what you've put together, how you measure to determine the competitiveness that you shared with us?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dean.
What I'd like to do is actually present two different numbers to you that I didn't go into great detail in my testimony. The first is looking at basically the results of the 2010 election, and this is the conversation that Senator Gerlach and I had during the last committee hearing on the principles. And so what I found looking at the 2010 numbers is that you basically created on the Senate side 33 safe Republican districts, 19 safe DFL districts, and 15 competitive districts. And a competitive district is basically defined as a margin within plus or minus 4%. And then on the House side, you created basically 67 safe Republican districts, 40 safe DFL districts, and 27 swing districts. And so that's my individual analysis. And then there was the analysis provided by Professor Michael McDonald.
Senator Gerlach, just to that.
If I could, a question just to that point, Mr. Dean, you said plus or minus 4%. Plus or minus 4% of what?
Of the results. So looking at, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. I appreciate that. I'm with you. Mr. Okay. Dean.
What we did is we looked at the 2010 gubernatorial race. And what you do, this is the conversation that you and I had. So what you have to do when you do this type of analysis, you need to create a sort of a one-to-one ratio looking at DFL versus Republican. And so you basically don't include sort of those Independence Party results. And so looking at that one-to-one, basically a fair result would basically be 50%. And so in this, we found that, so looking at the gubernatorial race, let's just look at, I don't know what your new district is. Do you know what your new district is, your number?
57, Mr. Chairman.
So in District 57, it found that Governor Dayton would have received 44% of the vote. And so that would be considered basically a safe Republican-leaning district. So congratulations, you're in a safe Republican-leaning district. And so that's how we determine is that plus or minus 4%. So basically, for a Republican would have to receive, it's sort of within that 54 to 46% sort of margin.
Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, I'm confused now because in the previous committee hearing we had Mr. Dean testified and lauded a standard of competitiveness being an average of constitutional races and that was considered a very good measure. But now you've done an analysis not based on an average of constitutional officer elections, but you've chosen a gubernatorial race. And that was the problem from the beginning of what standard do you use? And Mr. Dean, you yourself lauded one in one hearing, and the next hearing you've dumped that and chosen another one. So, Mr. Chairman, I mean, that gets into the problem of what exactly is political competitiveness. We all have a different view of that.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Dean?
Just to respond briefly, I didn't get to continue sort of the second part of my testimony. And so, as we've discussed, there are multiple ways to evaluate competition in this, and I've presented sort of one. The challenge, quite honestly, again, has been very limited time to actually sit down and review this. And so we're trying to quickly sort of put together all these numbers. And so I haven't had time to go through and do that complete analysis of all the constitutional officers. However, the second part of my testimony was focusing on the memo from Professor Michael McDonald of George Mason University. And I believe the standard that he has put forward would really sort of be the ideal standard in terms of how you evaluate what he describes not as competition, but as political bias in the scale. Because this is a standard or methodology that's been used by multiple courts. It's been used by the New Jersey Supreme Court. It's been used in the Texas redistricting process, also looking at partisan gerrymandering in Pennsylvania. So it's a widely held sort of standard. And in his review of this, he describes it basically, again, as a partisan gerrymandering looking at how the districts were created. And so, again, I'd be happy to share this with you. You can review the methodology. As part of this methodology, he also talks about how this has been extensively peer-reviewed. And so I would consider this really the ideal standard if you want to look at political bias in a redistricting process. So I will share that.
Thank you, Mr. Dean.
Thank you.
Members, further discussion or amendments to House File 1425?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just a little curious what the process is going to be the remaining 2 weeks of the session. We didn't have any public meetings out in the communities relative to prior to the development of the map. So I'm curious if there are going to be some now before we actually take the map up on the floor, where it may be subject to amendment. May I just think back to, and I'm always careful about what I read in the newspaper for fear of people being misquoted, but I'm pretty sure I remember I think it was an NPR interview that you did where you indicated that you thought it was important that that the committee go out on the road, take testimony in communities relative to redistricting. And I'm wondering if you've changed your mind on that, because that wasn't a quote in a newspaper. That actually was an interview where I think I heard the sound on it just relatively recently, actually. But so if you've had a change, are we going to do that before we take it up on the floor, or have you just changed your mind on that?
Senator Bach, I don't recall the exact quote, but I do think we have benefited from the discussion and the testimony that we've had here. I also think we've benefited from the House hearings, and they have had some of those road shows. I'm not even sure. You might have even gone to the one in Hermantown. No. We're crunched for time. You know, the reality is we got the numbers from the Census Bureau in March, and we've got a May 23rd deadline. So this plan has been posted now, at least the guts of it. It has been amended since, but for over a week now. Let me ask it this way, Senator Bach. Do you have a plan? Do you have a plan that you're going to offer either here or on the floor?
Senator Michel, based on what I saw happen here when we tried to amend the principles, and I don't believe we even got one Republican vote on some very sensible changes to the principles, it seems a bit like a futile effort on our part. But I guess I would reserve the right potentially to offer amendments on the floor.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we talk about the timeline. Redistricting principles are not dependent upon census information. And if we had really had the transparent and straightforward process, we would have adopted redistricting principles way before. We could have done that in February, way before we got the census data. We didn't need to get the census data to then determine what our principles were going to be simultaneously with maps being, or almost simultaneously with maps being published. We could have gone out to the public and taken testimony around the state, and I don't consider having testimony from the citizens being a roadshow. But we could have, even if you want to call it that, we could have taken out, gone and listened to the people, the various communities of interest, the various areas of the state, and heard from the people what they thought our redistricting principles could have been. Then we could have passed redistricting principles, gotten the census data, measured the census data and our map drawing against the principles. That we did not do, and that was not a matter of a time crunch. We had plenty of time to do that. So I take issue with your characterization of not having enough time to to do this and not having enough time to listen to the people. We, as Senator Bach indicated, we tried very hard to participate in the process, hoping for a bipartisan result, and were rebuffed at every turn. Offering a map or a plan, the history of the treatment or the behavior does not bode well that any plan other than the one you have here, regardless of who it's offered by, would be considered seriously by the Republican majority.
Well, Senator Est, I do want to note and maybe just ask you, I mean, you know that I personally reached out to you and personally reached out to Senator Bach multiple times to have that kind of a conversation. We have also done had similar conversations and meetings with the governor's office, in particular Mr. Watson comes to this with some experience. So find it hard to, I guess the word rebuffed was rubbing me a little wrong there, Senator Est. Senator Est.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in issues like this, there is a level of trust that needs to be established, and I believe, and I had indicated to you, first of all, I had approached you on a number of times about dealing with redistricting principles before we got the census data, and we hardly had a meeting, so that kind of fell by the wayside. And then in terms of a matter of trust in adopting the redistricting principles, I had also indicated to you that establishing a floor of trust was, in our minds, to be determined by how welcome our suggestions for things like public comment and incumbent neutrality, competitiveness, which had been adopted in principles adopted by the courts in the past, how well they would be received or received at all. So the proof of trust building or lack of it came in the hearing in which the redistricting principles were adopted on a straight party line vote. So certainly your personal behavior was not rebuffing to us, but the actions taken by the committee as with you as chair gave the proof to my statement.
Well, members, I don't want to belabor this, Senator Rest, but I do think in most, on the matter of principles, I don't think you disagree with the principles that are embedded in this document. You may disagree with some of the ordering of them, and you may wish you wanted to add some more items. I would concede that point, but I think over time, principles have stayed relatively consistent, you know, talking about nesting and equal population, contiguity and compactness, minority representation, preserving communities of interest. That is what we have done. I'm sure that every one of those terms was in the principles that you would have that you did draft and would have wanted us to pass. So that is what we have before us. It's not even early May anymore. It's mid-May. And you have had the benefit of all the census data and all the machinery and the staffing that you need to come together with a plan, and you don't have one for us today, so that is your prerogative. But we have a plan before us. It is fair. It meets all the principles that we've discussed. And barring further discussion, I guess I'll just put it on the table. I would move House File 1420, 25 to be passed to the full Rules Committee. Recommended to pass and sent to the Rules Committee.
Mr. Chairman, I would request a roll call and be printed in the journal. We need three members.
Okay, got it.
And then I have a comment.
And you said you had a statement, Senator Rest.
Yes. We have, and I'm sure you have received, I hope, comments from the public, and I would like to pass out two of them so that people can understand that process is important to constituents in this activity. And Mr. Chairman, I don't have any particular comment on these. I just would want to make sure that people understand that people do care about this process. And I didn't hear you recognize that my motion was for a roll call to be printed in the journal.
I recognize that, Senator Rice.
Okay. Here's the other one. And my question would be, Senator Koch, these were addressed to you, but curious if you've received other communications about redistricting that you'd like to share with us, all of us. Anybody?
Senator Est, I'm not sure. I'm now not understanding your...
Here are two letters that we received copies of from Minnesota citizens talking about this process and the maps. And I was just curious if others had received copies or letters directly to them or copies sent to the majority leader or the minority leader or anybody. Just curious.
And so, Senator Koch, I will be happy to recognize. I would just note, Senator Rest, these are dated today, May 10th, and I don't know if you've checked your mail recently, but
Senator, well, these came today, but are there? I'm just curious about whether there were others. That's all,
Senator Rest. I got to tell you, if you see my desk, if you see my office, it's a little snowed under, but happy to see these and appreciate you bringing them to the committee.
Further discussion or...
So, Mr. Chairman, are we... Maybe
Senator
you, would,
Bach.
As the chair of the committee, did you receive any communications from citizens expressing any concerns with the map as it's been out there and posted, or did it... I mean, these two would just happen to be addressed to Senator Koch, but have there been others, I guess, that either of you have received that the committee maybe should be aware of?
Senator Bach, I can check my email and my inbox, but I'm not aware of any. Now, specific correspondence, is that what you're looking for?
Well, Mr. Chairman, relative to comments about, the plan has been posted out there for a while. Have there been any citizens of the state that have contacted you, the chair of the committee, expressing any concerns with what we were about to consider? And it's just, and if there's not, there's not. I guess I just was interested to know if there was.
Yeah, Senator Bach, I would guess I have a mix of comments and commentary on just about every bill we take up and measure that comes before us, and I believe that that would include redistricting as well. In the last week, as you say, after this has been publicized.
Senator Koch, did you have?
Well, no, I just, again, noticing these are May 10th, so I'm glad Senator Rest and Senator Bach can get to my mail that quickly, but.
The copies were sent to us on.
I didn't notice that they don't reference that you're copied on them.
I don't.
No, they don't.
I don't go
that.
To your desk.
Well, I appreciate that, Senator Rest. You're just not copied on these, so I was curious. But.
So.
You're welcome to, Senator Rest. It's a mess.
So, Senator Rest, just to be clear, because, and maybe Mr. Bodern can explain this, but because this is a subcommittee, I want to answer Senator Rest's request for a roll call vote. That we can do that, but for a printing in the journal, Mr. Bodern has a comment on that.
I think that can't happen.
Mr. Chairman, since this is a subcommittee and Rule 12.10 refers to printing a committee report in the journal, this subcommittee report will go to the Rules Committee. It cannot be printed in the journal.
Okay. You can do it in the Rules Committee itself. That would be just as well. And it's on the tape.
Right. And members, I appreciate your flexibility on the time. I'm looking at the clock right now. I'm going to recess for 15 minutes, and then we can come back for either further discussion or Senator Rest's motion for a roll call. So committee's in recess.
What is the reason for the recess?
I have one conflict, Senator Rest, across the hall here with a jobs conference committee. So committee's in recess.